You're listening to Software Unscripted. I'm your host, Richard Feldman. Today I'm talking with Lucas Rosa, a compiler engineer working on Aiken, which is a programming language for smart contracts. He's also one of the earliest contributors to the Rock programming language and the first person ever to get a tattoo of the Rock logo. We talk about trade-offs in language and compiler design, property-based testing, syntax and familiarity, and compile time evaluation of constants. And now, compiling smart contracts. All right, Lucas, thanks for joining me.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. So you were telling me that the programming language you're working on is one that has property-based testing as actually part of the syntax of the language. Like it's baked all the way into the language level. Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
That's cool. Yeah. So I don't know of any other languages that have done that. What was the decision-making process that led to that happening?
Yeah, I'm not sure of any other ones either, except maybe Unison, which I believe has something like that.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I remember going through the tutorial and doing some property tests as part of it.
Cool.
So the motivation for us, well, one, the core team of this language, Aiken, into functional programming at the very least. And one of our core team members has also been writing Haskell professionally for quite a while. And so he's familiar with Quick Check and things like that. And he read this paper on shrinking. And so he was kind of responsible for implementing it. And the domain that this language is for is financial smart contract. And so being able to have as many testing utilities as possible is important for the domain. And so prop testing at the language level seemed like a no-brainer. It was on the roadmap from day one, basically. I didn't know how we were going to do it, but I was like, I want that. And luckily, eventually, the people I was working with, one of them knew how to do it, or at least had some ideas, and they just followed the code and the unit tests until they got to where they wanted to go.
Yeah, that makes sense. I remember in the second version of Elm Test, so somebody else made the first version of Elm Test, and I made version two, and one of my goals was to integrate it in at the level of the test runner and try to make it so it was a first-class thing and that you didn't have to go to a separate library to integrate it. And I remember one of the things that was tricky about that was making sure that you could reproduce failures. So I'm not sure what your design is, but the way that we did it was we would thread a random number generation seed through every single test. And then that way, if a test failed on one of the randomly generated runs, we could print out, hey, here's the seed that you can pass back in as a command line argument that'll definitely 100% of the time reproduce this failure.
Right.
Is that something that you've been doing too?
That's literally what it does. And the implementer borrowed so many ideas from the Elm stuff, actually.
Okay, cool, cool. Yeah.
I didn't realize, but that's probably where the replayable seed came from. So that's a funny coincidence you mentioned that.
Yeah, as long as you have pure functions everywhere, I mean, it's 100% reproducible.
Right. And so the beautiful thing about this domain that we're operating in is that the virtual machine for this language is as pure as it gets. Because if you think about it, like this is in a distributed system like context, and you're running contracts from like, you don't know who wrote this code that you're executing. Uh-huh. So you don't want to let it do things like IO of any kind.
Literally,
no file system access. You can't console log, at least not in the way that you usually would. So there's none of that. And so it's really literally like it gets some payloads to validate a transaction and then returns true or false. And depending on the result of that, the transaction is allowed to proceed or be rejected.
Got it.
And so it's actually one of the most interesting applications of pure functional programming I've seen because there's literally no IO.
Yeah, it's like there's always that old joke of like, well, you know, you need effects in order to do anything. Otherwise, you're just making the CPU get hot. And it's like, well, what?
Which is a mean-ish kind of thing.
Right.
But also, there's something there.
Right. But it's a good example of like, what if the thing that you're doing is enforcing rules in a contract? I mean, laws don't involve IO. And like laws are a special case of rules.
Right. And in this case, it's controlling what funds are allowed to be spent.
Uh-huh.
In different ways. So it's an interesting sort of domain in general and like an application. I don't know. The virtual machine, like that's kind of how the project started. The virtual machine was originally implemented. It's a CEK machine. Fundamentally, the virtual machine is just executing a simple Lambda calculus with some extensions and to have like various built-ins of like 74 built-ins or something like that. It's a small number of built-ins. So we started off just replicating this virtual machine in Rust. The original implementation was in Haskell. And then we had the encoding and decoding of the binary format for this textual Lambda calculus. And then it just made sense to like, let's build our own language on top of this. And so we took a lot of what Gleam had, actually. Yeah, so we got a nice head start because of Gleam. So thanks a lot to Lewis. He's done some amazing things there. And I just loved it so much that I was like, well, I want a lot of that stuff for what I'm doing. And so there's entire modules there that it's just like a copy and paste from Gleam. You know what I mean? Not all of it. There's a bunch of stuff we changed, right? Like I made some mild syntax changes here and there. Instead of import, we have use as the keyword for that. And then when is for pattern matching that we borrowed from Rock.
Nice.
Yeah. So a bit of a child language of Rock in a sense.
Well, it sounds like there's quite a few different influences there.
Yeah, for sure.
Funny you mentioned Gleam. It's not out yet as of this recording, but the previous person I had on the podcast was actually Louis and talking about Gleam 1.0.
No way.
Yeah. Small world.
That's so cool. I interact with him on GitHub through a Gleam library that I have actually called like IDs, like IDS. And I just was like maybe 2-3 years ago or something like that. I forget exactly, but as I found Gleam and I was like, oh, I want to play with it. You know, I was already into Elixir and like the sort of Erlang family of languages. So I was like, oh, the more the merrier, right? Played with it a little bit and I was like, it'd be okay. Maybe I can try a little library with this thing. And I was like, okay, I'll make a little library that aggregates the various different ways to generate unique IDs.
Ah, okay.
Like nano IDs, hash IDs, snowflake ID, UUID, CUID.
I've only heard of one of those. Wow.
It is a bunch. Right. I didn't know some of them either until people started contributing to the library, which is kind of like the beautiful part of the source. You never know who's going to show up.
Right.
And it's always someone on the other side of the world. And it's like, oh, cool. Like I got a friend in Japan now, I guess. That's awesome.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so he has been regularly either making issues or making pull requests to that library to make sure it's compatible with the latest versions of Gleam. And now I'm not sure if he uses this library himself or if it's like part of a larger effort of helping ecosystem libraries not be outdated as he makes changes quickly to the compiler. So I don't want to make myself feel special by saying like, oh yeah, he totally helps with my thing. It could just be that I'm one of many that he helps keep up to date.
Nice. Yeah. It's funny, you mentioned meeting people all over the world from open source projects. So there's going to be this conference in Milan, Italy, depending on when this episode comes out, maybe in about a month from when it comes out, middle of May 2024, depending on when you're listening to this. And it's called Software You Can Love, or SYCL.IT. And previously, it's been mostly Zig talks.
Yeah.
But it's always aspired to be not just a Zig conference, but like a broader topic than that. And this year, it's kind of unofficially like Zig and Rock. So we have, I think, 3, maybe 4 Rock talks.
I saw.
Yeah. And so one of the contributors to Rock, like one of the biggest contributors, Luke Boswell, he lives in Australia and he's planning to fly 20 hours to come to this conference and hang out with everybody, which is amazing. And I'm super excited to actually get to finally meet in person.
Yeah. Australia is a tough one in terms of flight time for sure. That's cool, actually. I think he came around after I started contributing less.
Yeah.
Because that name's less familiar. Because I recognize some of the other talks, like the names from the other talks, right? Like Folcourt and then Brendan and stuff like that. And I was like, oh, cool. Look at them. Let's go.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. So I think you were really active in Rock stuff around 2020, I want to say, like 2021.
Yeah, like 2020, 2021.
Yeah, right.
Around when we went to like Handmade Seattle.
That's right. Yeah.
The Zig guys.
Yep, I remember this now. Okay, yeah. Yeah, so there's quite a few more people in the community now.
That's awesome, man.
They're great people. And a lot of the people that you remember are still around also, like Folkert and Brendan and several others. But yeah, it's cool to see the community grow and to just meet new awesome people who I just like, I have no idea they existed. And now I get to meet them and hang out with them. And yeah, it's more than just like we're collaborating on a project. It's also just like Brendan made this awesome blanket for my son.
Oh, that's so cool.
He hand-stitched a Rock logo into a blanket. My son's worn that so many times, especially in the winter, because we actually get snow here.
Yeah. You make genuine friendships, right?
It's not
unusual. I feel like a lot of that Software You Can Love stuff that you mentioned was born out of that kind of energy. It was people meeting online interested in Zig, and then a lot of them met up at Handmade Seattle, and then there started being these Software You Can Love events repeatedly after that.
Yeah, so and
it's cool to see like that kind of grow, you know?
I don't want to speak for Loris, who created the conference series,
but of course.
I think that my interpretation of the goal of Software You Can Love as sort of like a philosophical thing is really it's like software you can love as opposed to software that's essentially just made for profit or for trying to solve a problem in the fastest way possible or something like that. It's like the subset of software that's created because you really just want to create something excellent that's like, that's really great for your users, that's lovable, that's delightful, things like that.
Right.
Which is not all software in the world. No, but
definitely.
To be fair, there are totally valid reasons to make other types of software. As an example, maybe if someone's like, hey, there was just a big natural disaster, I'm going to try to write some software as fast as possible to help people coordinate, whatever. Maybe making it lovable is not the biggest priority there. Maybe the biggest priority is like getting it out the door fast so that it can help people.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, there is and should be a lot of software in the world that is designed to be like, let's just try to make it as great as we can for the end user. And even if that requires taking our time on it. And I like that. I want to be a part of that. That's the type of software that I'm most excited about creating.
Yeah. And for me, I also get this vibe that it's also about enjoying the craft of producing the software, not just being like outcome orientated, like kind of seeing like, where is writing this code going to take us more or less?
I certainly think that's, I don't know if it's like a stated value of the conference, but like, certainly I, whether or not it is, I certainly think that's something that I expect approximately everyone attending to feel. Like, yeah. If you're not into the process of creating lovable software, then I would imagine that doesn't correlate well with like wanting to go to that conference.
Yeah, 100%. Loris is great. I've been meaning to go to those, but I'm terrified of flying. I'm just like not like rather tall, rather like about 2 meters. So like I don't want to be on a plane for too long. It's like, oh, how long does it take to get to Italy from Miami? And then it's
yeah,
like, oh, over 10 hours? I'm sorry. It's going to be hard.
Yeah. Fortunately, not that tall. I'm like 5'10", which I don't know how much that is in meters, but I guess like 5'11". That's almost, but I'm just tall enough, and a lot of my height is in legs, unfortunately, which is sort of like, well, as long as I'm in the right seat, it's fine. But if there's not enough leg room, then it can actually be uncomfortable for the whole ride. But I've never actually flown internationally in anything other than normal class, like maybe exit row, a little extra leg room. But I have some family friends who recently had a very long international trip. It's like 14 hours or something like that. And somehow either they paid for it or they managed to get into business class. And they're like, this is the only way we're flying from now on. This, like, well, you can afford it.
It's a dangerous addiction.
Yeah, right.
It's an expensive habit.
Yeah. Speaking of Australia, there's a whole conference series there called YAO. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's centered around functional programming.
Oh, and that's so cool.
I was talking to Dave Thomas, who was one of the original organizers. I think he's kind of stepped back from organizing now, but he and I were at a different conference and we're chatting about things. And he basically explained that the idea for this conference series came up because the flight to Australia is just so long and it's expensive, in addition to being sort of a big ask for a speaker, that they were just having trouble logistically getting speakers to justify coming out to their conferences. And so the solution they came up with was basically do a conference circuit where you have a conference in, I think it's like Melbourne, Brisbane, and Sydney. And then you just sort of stagger the conferences a little bit so that you can have a speaker fly out, do the long trip to Australia, and they go speak at one conference and then have some number of days off to check out the city or something, and then fly to the next city, do the same talk there, and then do the same thing again a third time. Mm-hmm. So it's like, on the one hand, it's a long flight, but on the other hand, you get to be in Australia for like a week, maybe plus, and the conference is paying for that. That's kind of a cool opportunity for a speaker.
Yeah.
Compared to a normal conference, it's a bigger time commitment, but also there's like a perk there where it's like, well, when else are you going to get to see Australia?
Tour of Australia. Let's go.
Yeah. So I know some people who have done this. Unfortunately, I'm now in a position where I have done enough talks that I've been offered to come out there and do that. But now I have a kid. And so now like taking a week is not as easy as it used to be.
Yeah, for sure. Speaking of flying and conferences, I'm actually probably going to be in Europe for the first time in April.
Nice.
Like the language that I helped create is for a specific community, the Cardano community. And so there's never been, and in that ecosystem in general, there tends to be more commercial events, which are like way less interesting for developers and software engineers, right? We want to see someone give a talk with like code on the slides. It's like, show me some code, man.
That's generally my, that is generally the case, yeah.
Right, exactly. So there hasn't been such a thing, at least for Cardano, that we've seen so far. And so a couple of people got chatting, and my boss at the Cardano Foundation and two other people, maybe one other person, started organizing something that's going to happen in Toulouse, France. I think I'm saying that correctly. Maybe not.
I have no idea.
It's like Southern France, I think.
I'm American, and, so I try to just avoid pronouncing anything that's not English.
Toulouse if I can. Or something, right? So I'm probably going to go to that, and that's going to be interesting. And then there's actually other languages for Cardano. The one that I built isn't the only one. It's just the one that's kind of gotten the biggest at the moment. And there was like this huge push to like actually look for alternatives, because the default tool set for writing these smart contracts was actually leaving people with a lot to be desired. It was like this kind of like template Haskell DSL that got real frustrated, and you had JavaScript developers coming in and trying to use Nix and Haskell for the first time. So it was like a lot of like friction in terms of like being able to build applications on top of Cardano. And so my personal goal was, I want to make that easier and create a language that's up to the par for like, it meets the experience that I would expect. Uh-huh. Like a modern language or whatever, that like a language coming out nowadays, right? So some basic things usually, right? Like has an LSP, has a formatter.
Sure.
Has like a simple Hindley Milner type system with the whole unification stuff, which is nice. And so I'm going to be part of some panel where like all of the different languages kind of chat about the different details of their languages and stuff like that. And
get into a big fist fight about,
yeah, maybe. And then there's going to be like some other talks about like cryptography and zero knowledge cryptography and interesting things like that.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. The extent of what I know about Cardano is that it's a blockchain thing. And that's like kind of it.
It is. And I know that's unsavory, but I'm more into the interesting kind of aspects of the technology side of it than anything else.
Well, I wonder about like, so smart contracts doesn't seem like it's necessarily coupled to any particular, I mean, I know you said that this language is sort of designed for Cardano, but is it something that could be used for any kind of smart contract? Like if I wanted to enter into a contract with somebody else using like US dollars, is that something I could use Aiken for?
Yeah, I mean, not in its current state, because its compilation target is this Lambda calculus known as untyped Plutus core. In the same way, like
you have no idea what that is.
Yeah. So it's just like Cardano is a blockchain. And so you have what you would call a node. And the node has the ledger and a virtual machine inside of it to execute these smart contracts. And then you can assume that around the world, there's like 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, whatever, other people running the same exact copy of the same software. And then these things are communicating with each other using a consensus algorithm, or like they're keeping some state in sync using a consensus algorithm, right, between each other, called Ouroboros, right?
But that's not a like a design constraint of the language. That's just like okay, so right now that's the only compilation target, but you could have other compilation targets in the future.
Yeah. And I mean, like, could this virtual machine, and this is like right now, like the main, let's say, right? Like what is main in an Aiken program, right? Main is, we call those validators. And in an Aiken project, you can define as many mains as you want, or as many validators as you want, because they're just like basically like producing a bunch of binaries, right, that all have an entry point, right? And so the entry point is generally a three argument function. And the third argument is of a type that's always known, called the script context. And that contains a bunch of information. It's just like some record, right? That has a bunch of information about the context of the transaction that the script is executing in.
Gotcha.
And so if you were to create some kind of other scheme, perhaps maybe a different distributed system or a not distributed system, and you still wanted to run this kind of thing for whatever reason, yeah, you could. And then you could satisfy that kind of interface or redefine it yourself and fork the compiler and make it so that it wants you to have two argument functions or one argument. But that's how it works, right?
Gotcha.
So it's like a transaction comes into a node. The node receives it, basically checks it, a bunch of basic checks, and then it goes into what they call phase two validation. And that's essentially checking if the transaction includes any scripts to be executed. And if it does, it then basically prepares a payload, three payloads really, right? Three arguments to be then passed into this smart contract. And then it executes, and then true or false means it goes through or doesn't go through. So you could use that in other, I don't know where you would use it, right? It makes sense for this situation where you have a distributed ledger where you want to be able to validate or extend the validation logic of transactions with scripting.
I see. This actually brings me to a question I've always had, where when I first started hearing about smart contracts, my first thought was like, this seems like a use case where dependent types sound more valuable and promising than any other thing I've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is that something people are doing?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we're looking at Cardano specifically, Cardano's like the whole, from philosophy, design, architecture to tools used, is like a functional first thing to the core. Even to like I think, who created, there's like a notable I think Philip Wadler is involved in some ways, like things like that.
Could be. I mean, I don't know. I've had like a 5-sentence conversation with Phil Wadler once at a Strange Loop long ago.
No, for sure. But you know, like there's like involvement from like a lot of these notable Haskell figures, so to speak.
Okay.
And so it's very functional kind of core to it. And then, you know what? I totally forgot your question.
Well, so that's fine. So typically about dependent types. So I like,
right, okay, yes.
Like the idea of, for example, being able to express in the type system, like a relationship between two numbers, like the actual values.
Yes.
And I guess like refinement types let you do the same kinds of things. Well, like, for example, it seemed like being able to say at the type level, perhaps there is no possible way that like this number can be less than this other number, and being able to statically verify that about the program seems like, if I'm, for example, going to enter into a contract with someone that's going to be enforced automatically, that's a property I would like to know, is like, hey, I, you know, just right. Basically being able to know certain things statically that I don't have to worry about, oh, did they make a sneaky little conditional in here? They're like, no, it's like, it's statically that this number is always less than this number, and I can prove that at compile time. That, yeah. I mean, naively, as someone who's never entered into any kind of smart contract, it sounds like the type of thing that would be valuable, but I don't know, maybe it is or isn't in practice. I'm just curious.
I think it is. And I guess that's what I was trying to get at by mentioning all that Haskell stuff, is that like the very nature of all of this stuff, it's designed in such a way that it's easy to formally verify.
I see.
There's determinism in the transactions, right? So you can know how much a transaction is going to cost before it's submitted and things like that.
Sure.
In Eichen, for example, if we were to do like a dependent type kind of thing, a really valuable one would be able to statically verify the lengths of certain byte arrays or byte strings, if you use Haskell, so that you could be like, you can never use a public key of the wrong length, for example.
Ah, okay.
Like stuff like that in that territory, I could see it going in that direction, right? Basically, as you said, like statically knowing certain kinds of, yeah, for sure. I think it would be valuable, especially in this domain more than anything.
So the two type system features that seem relevant here would be dependent types and refinement types. I don't know, are those terms that people throw around as like, in Haskell, I think maybe even in like mainline GHC now, I haven't really kept up with this. I know dependent types have been working on to getting into Haskell, and I know that like there are, actually the current release, you just have it. And then also refinement types, like Liquid Haskell is an extension to Haskell that gets your refinement types. Is that something that like maybe some of the other people on the panel are using, or like the people who are doing Haskell things?
I would need to check. I'm not sure, because they do have some kind of more interesting esoteric things that they have the capacity to work on, right? Like the core team that invented and works on the Haskell implementation of untyped Plutus core, or Plutus is kind of like the name of like the family of all of these tools, right? You have like typed Plutus core, untyped Plutus core, the machine that executes both. They're a pretty stacked team with that kind of stuff. So I wouldn't be surprised if stuff like that is on their radar, right? Where Eichen is kind of more less about the fancy stuff, and more about like, how do we make this cool stuff that these people invented accessible to JavaScript developers?
Yeah.
So it's a functional language, actually, that has curly braces, right? And there was like a decision early on. It's like, do we do like the space-aware indentation, like Elm style, or do we do curly braces? And curly braces ultimately made sense, because we were hearing so many complaints about people coming into the ecosystem being like, wow, I can't even read Haskell. And it's like, all right, we get the message. Right. Yes, it's a wonderful thing, but it's not for you guys. So we'll make something for you guys, right? But you still get the nice functional stuff too. You don't have to keep those two things separated.
Yeah, the syntax question is really, really interesting. So I'm aware of three languages that have gotten significant traction. So let's say Eichen is one of them. Is it Eichen or Eichen? It's Eichen, right?
So yeah, either one is fine, but like it's named after Howard Eichen. So you would say it like Clay Eichen or whatever, right?
Okay. All right, I'll say Eichen, because that's sure.
Do the one you want.
All right. That's what I'm going with. So Eichen is a language that has curly braces, and within that particular niche, it sounds like it's got good traction if it's the most popular. So congrats, by the way, on making something like that people seem to like. 400
whole stars, homie.
And then Rescript is like OCaml under the hood, but then looks like JavaScript. And then Gleam, also curly brace sort of C or Algol style syntax, whatever you want to call that, depending on how far back you want to go.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think that's interesting. But then, you could argue that Rust is ultimately kind of has a strong enough OCaml influence that you could argue
it flirts functional.
Yeah, I would say Rust has some features that are also found in functional languages.
Right,
but it does have like, the original Rust compiler was written in OCaml. So
for sure.
definitely inspired by, like, the option type, like with some and none, that comes straight from OCaml, like the result type, but, you know, also OCaml.
Yeah.
Now, to me, the interesting thing about syntax question is twofold. One is there's the learning curve and the familiarity, obviously. I think the learning curve part, in my experience, just having taught a lot of people Elm, it doesn't take long to learn, but there is something that beginners do mess up pretty frequently, which is where the parentheses go. And this is specifically in nested function calls. So, like, if you have JavaScript or C or whatever style syntax, then the parentheses always go, open paren goes right after the name of the function. Whereas in Elm and Rock and Haskell, you don't need parentheses when you're calling a function. But if you're doing a nested function call, then you do need parentheses in order to show where one call begins and the next one ends.
Mm-hmm.
Interestingly, CoffeeScript did not have that problem because in CoffeeScript, function arguments are separated by commas. So you do still have sort of space-based thing, but then because you have commas next to the arguments, you don't have that problem. Now, the downside of that is we did consider putting commas next to our arguments in Rock.
Yeah.
There's this really nice DSL that you can get that Elm puts to great use, and I would like to have available in Rock too, which is when you have like a list of things, and inside the list, you're doing a lot of function calls. So if you do comma-separated function call arguments, now if you put those inside of a list, now you need parens around every single one of those, because otherwise you can't tell if it's a comma for the function call or it's a comma separating two list elements. It's just ambiguous. Yeah. The solution we came up with is to do the same thing that Elm does, which is don't have commas between your arguments. And then nested function calls, you do have to learn that you still need parentheses and you need them in a different place.
That's chill. I think it's okay. I don't think it's ugly or anything like that.
Oh, yeah. But like you said, I mean, some people have different tolerances for like unfamiliar syntax, even if it's like I can read this and understand it. And also, I mean, you did mention Haskell. Depending on what Haskell code you're looking at, it might be the lack of curly braces, or there's a lot of idioms that are used in a lot of Haskell code that even for people who are familiar with like Elm and Rock and or Ruby is also a language without curly braces, Python, they look at it and they go, that is a lot of symbols. And I don't know what they mean.
Yeah.
But that's kind of a separate question from the syntax of the language that you know operators are used.
And I think just like a writer or anything else, you kind of have to consider your audience. Who is this language for, right?
Yep.
And if it's general purpose, you can kind of safely assume you should try to be beginner friendly, at least in the setup, if you have to have a complicated language for whatever reason, right?
Yeah.
But like if in our situation, you kind of don't want a beginner in any way, shape, or form touching smart contracts due to the nature of it, right? There's sometimes literal billions of dollars trapped in these things. Hundreds of millions at the moment when it comes to Cardano, but like quite a lot in various different ecosystems across all of the ecosystems in general. It's quite a lot. And so does that mean that there's never beginners doing this stuff? No, for sure. Of course there is, right? Does that mean they should be? I don't know. That's not really like the point. But ideally, who are you designing the language for? And it's not really a beginner, right? And so for me, it's like, okay, like we can safely assume it's probably not a beginner trying to write smart contracts just because the culture of it is like already a gatekeeper. It's like, oh, like I'm not good enough to do that, right? I mean, people can try anything they want, but still, it is what it is. And so for us, what do most developers with experience know? And it's languages with curly braces.
True.
So that's just, it made sense for us. Like, is this going to be people been writing code for 5+ years at least, most likely, trying to use this stuff?
I mean, I guess in the data science world, it's kind of the same thing, but with Python, where it's like, what are people familiar with? Python syntax. There have been various discussions over the years of like, could Rock be a good language for data science? And
interesting.
One of the things that I keep coming back to that's just such a, and for context, when that comes up, it usually is accompanied by a discussion about there are certain language features that we could add. And if we added them, they'd pretty much only be for data science use cases. Like maybe they could be used in games a little bit, but it would be like, this is really something we're adding just so Rock can be better at data science. And the thing that I struggle with whenever that conversation comes up is that if we were to add those features, obviously it would increase the complexity of the language, and then everyone's just going to keep using Python.
Right.
Like, because, I mean, it seems to be the case that there is an even stronger monoculture for Python in data science than there is for, like, JavaScript in the browser, which is probably the second biggest, like, monoculture.
Yeah, I mean, not even Julia managed to really
Right. I mean, Julia, I think, as I understand it, is like the most successful non-Python dialect.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
But it's like, yeah, it's very, very small. Similarly, like Elm is the most successful non-JavaScript dialect in the browser, and it's just a very small percentage of all the browser-based code that gets written out there. And I love Elm, don't get me wrong, but I am not going to say like, oh, well, Elm's like 50-50. Of course it's not. It's way smaller than that.
50-50. They're rewriting Facebook and Elm.
Yeah. And the point is that, like, I think Rock, if people did start liking it for data science, I think it would be a distant second to Julia.
Right.
But even in that scenario, that's not to say that I don't care about people who want to use Rock for that. I certainly do.
Right.
But there is that trade-off of like, now we're making the language more complex for everybody. And is it worth it just so that a very small percentage of Rock developers can like use it for data science and enjoy doing it, which matters.
Right. But trade-off. Exactly. For sure. For sure.
And I think the emergence of Mojo as a language is a really good example of that, because that's coming out of Chris Lattner, and Chris Lattner did LLVM and did Swift. And
yes,
I mean, if you look at Swift, so first of all, he's had experience with making a C++ compiler from scratch when everybody was telling him, don't do that because that's not feasible. And he's like, well, let's do it anyway.
Yeah.
And now there are two major C++ compilers. But at the same time, it's also like, well, he knew how to make a language from scratch for a particular domain, because look at Swift. I mean, Swift does not look like Objective-C dialect, but it was like they had this problem space and he designed and developed a language that is now very widely used, namely Swift. And it uses all sorts of things from the ML family of languages and others.
Yeah, Swift is interesting.
Even having just done Swift as his most recent language, as soon as he gets into the AI machine learning world, et cetera, like not even necessarily data science as a focus, it's like, yeah, we're going for a Python dialect. We're going to try and make something that makes Python, it's like fundamentally Pythonic, but then we're going to add some extensions to it and so forth. And that kind of tells you that like in that world too, like the AI world, there's a pretty strong monoculture around Python use.
Yeah, it is what it is, right? Like, I don't know, maybe there's like some kind of interesting like sociological theory that could kind of expand on how that kind of happens and maybe why it's like tied to certain evolutionary traits of humans. But like, I don't know. I just say like, it is what it is. You just got to give the people what they want sometimes, you know?
Sure.
Like a sort of like a halfway to a customer is always right kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Not really, not with compilers. Right? Sometimes the customer's wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One more thought on the syntax thing. One of the things that motivates me or makes me think that it's a good idea to use the sort of space-based function calling specifically for that little like DSL thing is when I look at the JavaScript syntax and you look at, for example, React. So React is like, it came out with JSX, which is this whole like extra compilation step. It's a mix of HTML and JavaScript. It's like the XML tags essentially embedded in the JavaScript. Like you can do that. And that's a totally valid way of doing things. But to me, it is nicer if you don't need to do that because the syntax of the language is already amenable to just having a nice DSL for describing that tree structure without needing a sort of separate language or separate syntax embedded in the original syntax. And one of the oldest articles I ever got paid to write was about like React right after it had come out. And I was an early adopter of React. And at the time, the company I was working for used CoffeeScript. And so there was no JSX for CoffeeScript. And so the way I used React when it first came out was I was just like, oh, well, these are all just functions, like div is a function, button's a function. So I essentially just made a little CoffeeScript DSL that was just call the functions directly. There was no JSX. It didn't look like that, but it was very nice and easy to read. And in fact, it was kind of funny because when I later discovered Elm, it was like the same thing as the DSL I'd already independently come up with in CoffeeScript with like space-based function calls. And in both CoffeeScript and Elm, I thought it was a real asset to them that you didn't need a JSX to get that same sort of like tree structures just look good in the syntax.
Yeah.
And because there's more trees that you want to describe than just HTML. And another
the format is good and the nesting is appropriate.
Yeah.
Right. Like you don't really need the closing to be like a visual.
You don't need the like, right. And in some cases, like, you don't want tags to describe your tree structure. Like that looks weird. Yeah. Like it, HTML looks natural because that's the original syntax, but
you
know, there's other tree type structures that don't make sense for that. So to me, that's worth the, I totally agree with like, you know, give the people what they want certainly has value. But in this case, I'm like, yeah, I think that the utility of being able to have those sort of like DSLs without needing like a macro system or a template Haskell or things like that is just, well, I mean, Haskell has this particular DSL anyway, but
yeah.
But you know, that's to me worth the unfamiliarity cost, especially considering like sort of how minor it is.
Yeah, I mean, that makes perfect sense. And that doesn't mean there isn't room to like try new things or decide where it's appropriate to stick to your preferences, right? Like when designing one of these things.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, for you, you clearly you have your preference for syntax in a lot of ways. And I'm sure there might be some things in Rock that you don't love, but it's a trade-off because it's a little bit better for other people, you know? And,
sure.
Right? Like it's just part of the game, you know what I mean? And it's like, it's just hard to have everything in your language be something you love, especially when other people start getting involved.
Yeah. But at the same time, it's also like, to me, the most rewarding part of it is the fact that like other people are using it and including other people who have different preferences from my own. And one of the main things that I think is important for me to do a good job at is to try to balance all of that and not just make a language that's like exactly what I want, but something that's like, I have a vision. And for people who are bought into that general approach, like, how do I balance trying to make the nicest experience for as many people as possible, given the understanding that in some cases, accommodating one person will inconvenience or make the experience worse for everybody else, especially if you say yes to everything. And now you've ended up with a language that's horrendously complex for everyone. But each individual person says, well, yes, but I like that one incremental thing that was added just for me.
Yeah. And you know, an interesting way I've kind of learned to deal with that, right? Like people that might show up and like have a complaint and want like an immediate solution. Just kind of like have like a little chat. It's like, hey, like, okay, I hear you. I hear you have a problem with these things. Let's collect more data. Let's let more of this be a problem and see if we identify actually some kind of underlying pattern where there's a solution that can solve all of it at once. Right. And it's like an approach I've taken with Eichen is to like, you know, we don't solve things immediately. You know, we let something that might be annoying brew a little bit just to see, like, is there a pattern here?
I think patience is definitely important. And because sometimes if you look back at like decisions that you regret, sometimes the thing they have in common is it's like, yeah, if we'd known what we know now, we wouldn't have done that. So yeah, especially if you're considering making a change that's going to be hard to change your mind about later, it's like all else being equal, it's better to wait and get more data. That makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah.
Another pattern that I have noticed though, is that it's really easy to make a commitment to something that you think is going to be a problem, but then it turns out like you look at other languages and they're like, oh, they just like didn't do this and they didn't have the problem. So maybe we anticipated a problem that wasn't really there, which is really unfortunate because then sometimes it's like, it's too late. You can't really go back and undo it without breaking tons of stuff.
Yeah. And in Eichen, we have this kind of like, we're fortunate in that like the surface of the target is small. So it's like, there's less stuff to be worried about. So we can like kind of hyper-focus on the very domain specific aspects of it.
Yeah.
So we get to be even more patient than usual. And like, we don't have to jump into as many exotic language features as quickly, you know?
Yeah.
Because it's domain specific. We can always throw in like a, it's also dangerous though, right? It's tempting because it's like, since it's so domain specific, you can always just throw in a keyword that does something. And it's like, do you want to just be throwing in a bunch of keywords all the time to like do something? And it's like, maybe there's like a cleaner way to like make it happen with expressions. And if we just like change this part of like the type system, we can finesse it to where it works, right?
Yeah.
And so it's interesting kind of balance, I guess, true. Yeah.
You know, what's a funny pattern I've noticed? I'm not sure if you've seen this too, but a common thing that I've noticed, and I've seen this in other language communities I've been a part of as well, is that sometimes someone will enter the community, they'll try out the language, they'll get on chat or forum or something like that. And one of the earliest posts that they will make is a feature request. They'll say like, hey, I really like the language, but I really think this would improve it. And sometimes it's just like kind of a casual, like, oh, you know, here's an idea, just throwing it out there. Yeah. Other times it's like more of a push. And it's like, hey, like really, like, but you know, like I'm looking for a response here. And if you don't respond, like, hey, what do you think? Would you consider adding this? And then, okay, well, maybe let's wait and see. And the pattern that I've noticed is that most often with things like that, if you don't implement the thing and you just say like, hey, let's wait and see, if you circle back with that person, they stick with the language later on, they're like, ah, actually it's fine.
Yeah.
Like we're good. We don't really need that. It's just like, but it's hard to see that when you're a beginner because something jumps out at you. And on the one hand, that can be a sign that everybody gets used to this, but that's because everybody trips over the broken stair and then learns it not to step there. And so maybe that is something you should fix. But on the other hand, it can also be a sign that trying to fix that is going to introduce complexity that you could instead address by changing the learning materials, like emphasizing more upfront, like, hey, this is something you're going to get used to, but don't worry, everybody gets used to it. Some languages, I look at them and I look at certain features and design decisions, and I think this is something that really creates a lot of headaches for advanced users or introduces unnecessary complexity to the language. Yeah. And the problem that it's solving could have been solved with just saying, like, actually, it's fine. Like, people will just learn this and then, you know, they'll get over it.
Yeah.
But I think it's hard to decide correctly, like, when to do the one versus the other.
Yeah. I feel like I like to think I have good taste, but maybe that just comes with the territory of, like, even being, like, interested in designing one of these things. It's like, I like my ideas. Let's do it.
Sure.
You know, but anyways, jokes aside, right? Like, my favorite feature of Icon, actually, one of the more interesting ones is, you know, we have the regular pattern matching with, like, the match keyword or when is, right? And then we also have, and this kind of was born out of Gleam's, Gleam had, like, this, like, let assert thing. It was just assert at the time, but now it's like let assert.
Okay.
And basically you can say, like, let's say you have an option type, which is like a sum or none.
Uh-huh.
You can essentially, like, in one flat line, say, like, assert sum, inner pattern is a var, and then the right-hand side is some option type, instead of, like, doing a nesting with, like, a match. And basically, sure, if it's none, blow up or whatever. And so in our case, for Icon, this is perfect, because blowing up, you just return false and the transaction fails.
Perfect.
Instead of assert, we call it expect. And so we say expect, and then you can pattern match on multivariate construct, right? So you can pattern match on one, basically non-exhaustive pattern matches. That's what expect allows.
I see.
The exhaustiveness checking, by the way, is directly taken from Elm's implementation.
Nice.
For Icon. I don't think Gleam didn't have a complete one by the time I started borrowing the code. They have since implemented a fancy thing too. But when I borrowed the code, they didn't have something yet. And so we went and added something, and I borrowed it from Elm. It was perfect.
Yeah, the Elm code base is really kind of like a...
It's so clean.
Yeah, it's a well-written code base that also is, like, very featureful and also very battle-tested. So
yeah,
that's where the first version of Rock's Type Checker came from, was we just, like, straight up... I mean, it was obviously, like, we couldn't just copy it directly because Rock's compiler is written in Rust, but... I mean, it was literally down to the point where, like, when we had a bug, we would just go look, like, do a diff, you know, visual diff between our line by line, our implementation versus Elm's, like, oh, no, we forgot something here. Hang on. Okay. Bug. It was really, like, very, very direct in the early
days. Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah. So expect allows non-exhaustive pattern matching. And then basically, if it's not the pattern at runtime that you expected, it fails the validator, which is perfectly safe to do, right? Because then basically no money moves and you're good, right? You can also cast types using expect. So we actually have a kind of an interesting little form of typecasting. And we have, like, this, it's not any, we don't call it any, we call it data, right? D-A-T-A. And so there's this thing, the payloads that come into the smart contract at runtime are in this, it's basically a constant term in the underlying Lambda calculus.
Okay.
And the constant term is known as data. And then if you were to think of, like, what is the implementation, like, underlying data structure of this thing called Plutus data, it is itself an algebraic data type, right? And it is an algebraic data type that is structured to be able to represent algebraic data types as data, if that makes sense.
It's basically what dynamically typed languages do, right? Like, they have at runtime essentially an algebraic data type or some type or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
That just has, like, a tag of, like, what's my type? And then corresponding data that goes with that tag.
Yeah. And so the payloads that come in are of that shape, or they're, like, that structure in some shape, and, like, the shape of it matches, like, some type that you defined.
Yeah.
And because, like, this is, like, user input, there are, like, checks that we generate. So, like, any payloads that are coming in from the outside world, which are, like, the arguments to, like, your validator, top level main function, we actually generate runtime checks that makes sure that it conforms to the shape of your type.
Gotcha.
And then when you do a cast, so you can cast, so if you have something of type data, perhaps maybe, right, I'll explain that after actually. But if you have data on the right-hand side and you use expect on the left-hand side, you can provide an annotation that is a different type than data. And from then on in the scope, the compiler will treat that variable as though it's of the type you annotated it as, casting it essentially. And then at runtime, we will also generate checks that make sure that this any type conforms to the shape of what you expected it to be. So it's like a kind of like a safe casting, if you want to think of it that way.
Interesting.
If you want to consider it safe in any way. And it actually is super valuable for the domain. Because again, if it isn't what you expected, you just blow up, fail the transaction. And so, oh wow, I totally forgot the thing that I said I was going to explain after. Maybe I'll remember in a second, but whatever.
Yeah. I mean, well, that also sounds like, so the equivalent in like Java would be like a class cast exception or like in JavaScript, you would, I guess, I don't actually know if there is a equivalent in JavaScript. I guess it would be like instance of check at runtime and then if, you know, else throw an exception or something.
Yeah. Yeah. Right, exactly. But we have to generate a ton of recursive lambda calculus nonsense that runs at runtime. You know what I mean?
Uh-huh,
it's funny having like a lambda calculus as a compile target. It's interesting and simple at first, but then when you start getting into like implementing mutually recursive functions, it's a total nightmare.
Yeah, something funny that I realized at some point is that if you wanted to, I mean, so eval is like kind of this, it's famously associated with dynamic languages where you're like eval, like give it a string and it just evaluates it and that's something that dynamically or like interpreted languages do, but statically compiled languages don't. But technically, if you wanted to, you could, with a statically type-checked language, have support eval, like a straight up, you know, ordinary eval, arbitrary runtime string that you know nothing about. But what you have to do is A, you need to, you know, in your compiled binary, include a copy of the compiler so that it can compile it at runtime. And then B, do type inference on whatever that eval returns so that you can infer what the shape of the output needs to be. Right. And then when you are evaling that program, then you can do type checking on it at runtime and see, is that evaled string going to conform to the type that the rest of the program needs it to be? And if not, then, you know, blow up somehow.
Yeah, or like return a result and then the user handles
it. Sure, right. That's one option. There's like, you know, a number of different ways you could express failure. But
yeah.
I mean, you can totally do that. Have completely type safe eval. Well, type safe in the sense of like the errors are handled and it's never going to exhibit undefined behavior or anything like that.
Right.
Now, is that something people want? That's a different question.
Yeah, I have no idea. I couldn't think of a usage personally. Great, because it's not like it's at compile, it's at runtime. So, Oh, I remember. So, the thing I was going to mention is because I almost used a word that I hadn't introduced yet and it would have been confusing. So, there's this notion of an execution budget. Let's think of the context that Eiken is running in again. It's in a distributed system, no one trusts each other. You're just going to let somebody write an infinite loop and submit a transaction and freeze a node.
Good point.
So there's this notion of an upper limit of execution before like it just says, nah, dude, like game over, you ran out of, basically out of memory, you know, like done.
Yeah.
And it exits immediately. And we call that the execution budget. And it's based off of like some, like they have like a model and like some R code that like shows the relationship between the resources being consumed by the machine and the execution budget. So there's like some sensible defaults that go into it, attempting to model like actual resource consumption. And then ultimately, the amount of execution units that your smart contract consumes will affect the fee of the transaction. And so you can think of it as a gas kind of thing that you have to pay. And you may hear that term from like other ecosystems, gas. We don't call it that in Cardano, just a fee, right?
Uh-huh.
But yeah, so it's an interesting constraint for like the language as well, right? So we have to be super intense about generating optimized code. So you can get as much computation out of like you can as you can with the execution budget available.
Yeah. And that also sounds like something that has applicability in other domains. Like there's certainly, I mean, I was talking with Louis on the previous episode about having a playground on your website for your language where people can like, try out the language. And we were talking about the trade-offs between running that completely in the browser, like with WebAssembly, versus having servers that run that. And one of the things he pointed out is if you're running it on a server, now suddenly you have to be worried about bad actors executing code on your machine. And even if you've sort of locked down the security side of it and made sure that people are not able to compromise the machine and take it over, turn it into a botnet or part of a botnet or something, there's still the question of, like you said, what if they run an infinite loop and now that's just like spinning, using up resources, preventing other people from using it?
Right.
It's sort of like a generally useful concept to be able to say, like, here is a program that will take no more than this amount of resources on whatever machine it's running on.
Yeah, right. You can get as granular as resources in the case of what you were just talking about. I mean, that could just be like time, right? Like after 5 minutes, bro, like you're good. Like just done. Like a lambda, you know, just let those Lambda timeouts are brutal. It's like, oh, damn. What do you mean I'll have more than 15 seconds to serve a request back to somebody?
So this has come up in the context of one of the things that we're planning on introducing to Rock is it's somewhat of a behind the scenes feature, but also it'll affect things in ways that you'll be able to perceive, I guess, as a user of the language. But so what we want to do is compile time execution of constants. In other words, if you say like foo equals at the top level, that's like a constant and it's not a function. It's like you're actually, you know, going to make a value.
Yeah.
Whatever expression you put on the other side of that equals, we want to evaluate it completely at compile time and then put it in the static binary, basically the static data of the binary. So this not only is nice for efficiency purposes, but actually because of Rock's compilation model and how it essentially kind of compiles down to a C library behind the scenes that gets called by the host part of the platform, that actually solves some things that otherwise maybe don't behave the way that you would expect.
Right.
Anyway, so without going into too many detail about that, this does raise some questions around what happens if we are evaluating this at compile time and then you evaluate an infinite loop. Like in our case, that means like a tail recursive function that never terminates.
NCI.
Sure. Right? Like it could happen. And so then the question becomes like, well, what do you do about that? One thing you can potentially do about that is you can say, well, we're going to just put a time limit on it. But now you run into the problem of this works fine on my machine, but then as soon as I try to push code that pass all the tests on my machine, in CI, we have like a limited VM and it's slower because it's got like a fraction of a virtual CPU instead of like 16 cores on my laptop. And now it just takes longer and then it fails and I can't get CI to pass even though my code works. So that's not very good as a user experience.
Yeah.
Then another possible option you can do is you can say, well, let's just put like a recursion limit and you're only allowed to iterate this many times in a loop. But then you get into like, okay, but what if I actually want to iterate that many times in the loop to solve my problem? And you're like, oh, well, now I can bump the recursion limit. That also has a series of like negative trade-offs. The way that I'm currently thinking about it is just allow it and just say like, look, you can write an infinite loop and it might result in the compiler getting stuck in an infinite loop.
Figure it out.
Yeah. And maybe we can do something like if we're doing compile time evaluation, we can have a separate sort of monitor thread that kind of says, after some amount of time has passed, it's like, hey, FYI, I'm currently executing this function and it's taking a while. So there might be an infinite loop check in there. But
right, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. So then like you'd see extra maybe output on CI, but it wouldn't actually fail, but it would help you diagnose it. But at the end of the day, I kind of think that hopefully the number of situations where that would happen is kind of small because one of the nice things about doing recursion with like tail recursion is that you do have some nice options in terms of detecting, hey, I noticed that every branch of every conditional in this function results in calling itself. This is definitely an infinite loop. You know, a halting problem means you can't catch all of those, but that doesn't mean that you can catch none of them. It means that like there's a subset that you can catch and a subset that you can't catch. But my hope is that also like writing manual recursion in Rock is, I think, going to be a lot less common. So far it has been compared to, for example, using a fold or equivalent like that.
Right. Yeah.
So hopefully all things put together, it's like, this is the thing that theoretically can cause you problems, but in practice, like approximately nobody ever runs into it that the compiler hangs.
But it
can happen.
I mean, it's not as concerning because it's not a runtime issue, which would be like the big deal, right? It's like, that's the problem, but like, it's not, right? Like, it's just annoying that like there's an amazing solution.
I mean, so two things that are kind of weird about that particular use case. One thing that's weird about it is that you might say, well, it's really, really bad if your compiler hangs because that's the thing that you always expect to terminate is your compiler. Like you, when you do a build, you always expect the compiler to terminate. If the compiler doesn't terminate, that almost always means there's a bug in the compiler. Here, it would be like behaving as designed. So that's weird. On the other hand, specifically talking about evaluating compile time constants, it's 100% of the time going to hang. Like when you do that build, it's like definitely, there's no way you're going to, like the only way you could push it up to CI and be surprised that it hung on CI was that you just did not even try to build it locally.
Yeah.
Because as soon as you try to build it, it's going to evaluate that and it's going to be like, oh, yep. So with that in mind, it seems like one of those things where it's probably a reasonable idea to just try it out and see if people run into problems in practice. And if so, how often before trying to design in things that might have undesirable other consequences, as we've been talking about this whole time.
Yeah. You want to know something else that's interesting?
What's up?
Because the Aiken has no effects, we can actually also execute zero argument functions at compile time.
Oh, right? Sure.
So, yeah. Functions that take zero arguments are basically also like in the same, but there's no effects or anything like that. So it's like safe. Like, you know, it's going to like be the same thing every time, basically.
Of course. Right? Yeah.
And then there's no way to run the machine, the virtual machine, without, because we use the virtual machine itself to execute your code at compile time, right? And so there's no way to run it with no budget limit. It's the best we, so yeah, so it's like, it'll stop eventually for sure. But what we do is during those situations, or like when you're executing a unit test, because the unit test runs on the virtual machine too. The X, it's like X budget is the name of the type, and it has two fields, mem and CPU. And they're both like a U size or whatever. And so
okay.
The default budget, we just make like U size max when we're in the context of like testing and then compile time code evaluation. So then you get like ample budget to do quite a bit, at least in those contexts.
Yeah. Given the constraints, that's like, that's the best you could do, right?
Yeah. I mean, we could implement some changes into the virtual machine because we have a version of it in Rust that we re-implemented. And like, we could go just go in there and have a mode that just doesn't care.
Yeah.
But I'm like, whatever, man, just leave it.
It'll be like, wait to see if it's a problem in practice. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Cool.
I don't think we mentioned too much of the shrinking stuff from the prop testing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, prop testing does have integrated shrinking. It's based off of a paper. The team member that implemented it, Matthias, he did read that paper and he got the idea of it and looked at the Elm stuff. And so the counter examples that this thing produces are very nice, essentially.
Nice. Yeah. Max Goldstein did the shrinking implementation for Elm test. So shout out to Max back in the day. This is a long time ago now. But yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where I'm like, I'm aware of it and I know that it's important, but I've never really like gotten my hands dirty with implementing it. And so I don't really know how it works on a detailed level, but I'm really interested to learn about it because I remember talking to Evan Triplicki about this, who created Elm many years ago, and he did kind of go and do a dive on it. And his conclusion was that he came up with a way to do shrinking that seemed like it would have some really nice properties. I didn't really follow up with him about it. But also, I don't really have the shrinking vocabulary, I guess, to even have a conversation about that. So if he told me about it, I just be kind of like, neat, that sounds good. You know,
I can give you a link to the paper that we
used. That'd be good, thanks.
Yeah, and I was about to say, put this in Rock, man, just do it.
We've been talking about that, but also Brendan Hansconnect has some experience with fuzzing and distinction between like fuzzing and property-based testing. There's some stuff there that I understand and some stuff that I I'm like a little hazy on, but he's made a pretty compelling case that that's like a more ambitious and also more useful target to aim for. So we don't have anything in that way yet. It's all just sort of traditional testing stuff that's not property-based at all or fuzzing. But I like the idea of trying to integrate those types of things as the first-class thing in the language for Rock as well.
Nice. Yeah. So the language we use is fuzzing as well, right? So it's like we also have like a fuzz package that builds on the primitives that are baked in and then provides like higher-level utilities for you to then compose your own fuzzers or generators, right? And the way it works is a fuzzer is actually just, it's like a type alias with parameter type A equals. And then it's like a function that takes in like a seed and then returns like some kind of like a two tuple.
Gotcha.
And then we drive it all from the Rust side. And so it's like, we're like feeding the seed in between different runs back into the test. And it's, I don't know. You know, I wish I kind of like dug into it more how it works. You know, I plan on reading the paper just to kind of understand at least like how the shrinking part works. And then for the most part, though, what I understand is that like the implementation just has this Rust side and the seed is managed on the Rust side and just passed into these functions or these fuzzers or generators, however you want to call them. But yeah, when the discussion first started about when we were going to add prop testing to Aiken, there was a big caveat from Matthias about like, yes, people argue about fuzzing and prop testing, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, and this is the way I see it working, and this is how we're going to name everything. And it's like, all right, cool. No problem with me, man.
Nice. It's good when you get somebody who's like knowledgeable about a domain and can come up with a good design to like really address a problem well. And hopefully we'll be able to do the same thing in Rock.
Nice. Yeah. Sounds wonderful.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me about these things. I learned several things about technologies and communities that I'm not normally talking about. So I really appreciate you taking the time.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and it was nice talking to you again. It's been a little while.
Yeah, yeah. Cool. All right.